Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories along with Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Father Mick Ngundu has survived waves of violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Today, the Roman Catholic clergyman is actively working for poor people. He is a critic of corruption that he claims poisons chances of democracy. Recently, he described how many people in his homeland are too poor to pay for electricity. He spoke on the grounds of housing once used by Catholic religious workers in Normandy, France. Among the listeners was Veronique Cook, a retired worker. She has never been to an African country south of the Sahara Desert. The Frenchwoman may have never had a chance to hear Ngundu if not for a growing citizen movement called Living Libraries. It was created to end widely held but oversimplified ideas about groups of people through discussion. It allows you to discover what it's like to be that person. It's an opportunity to break barriers, said former French diplomat Natasha Waxman. She helped to launch a Living Library gathering this month in the French city of Caen. The movement comes at a time when a new report shows rising levels of xenophobia and hate speech across Europe. It said this has been partly driven by populism, terrorist attacks, and large numbers of non-Europeans migrating to the continent. The 47-member Council of Europe prepared the report. It listed Africans and Arabs as the newer targets of discrimination. It also noted older prejudices against Jews, Roma, and members of the LGBT community. Zeynep Ussal-Ganzir is a lawyer at the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance in Strasbourg. He said, "It's not that there is no will to change things, but it shows we need to make more efforts." Supporters of Living Libraries say they offer people a chance to meet those they might otherwise avoid and ask them hard questions. These people are called Living Books. Tina Mulcahy is head of the European Youth Center. She says, "The Living Books are often people who have personal experiences of discrimination or social exclusion that they are willing to share with the readers." She adds that instead of books, the readers can explore subjects that interest them, borrowing human books for one-on-one meetings. A Danish non-governmental organization set up the first Living Library nearly 20 years ago. The movement has since spread to more than 60 countries, including the United States. The recent event in Caen was crowded, as visitors sat down to talk with immigrants like Mick Ngundu. The clergyman said, "Since I experienced war, I can offer ideas for how to end it." Veronique Cook said her meeting with Ngundu taught her a lot about politics and development. Natasha Waxman is already thinking about how the Living Libraries model could bring Europeans together. "That would give people another image of Germans, for example," she said. She added that perhaps Britons would not have voted against leaving the European Union had they been more in contact with other EU nationals. In Normandy, some have asked Waxman about starting an online library. But that is one idea that she disagrees with. She said, I believe it's great that people actually get to meet, shake hands, look into each other's eyes. This creates an intimacy that's helpful in today's society.
This is what's trending today. Germany is out of the World Cup. The defending champions lost to South Korea 2-0 on Wednesday. Germany ended up last in Group F. Sweden and Mexico advanced from that group to the round of 16. South Korea did not advance, despite its surprising victory over Germany. It is the first time since 1938 that Germany has not advanced out of the group stage of World Cup play. All four Group F teams had a chance to advance Wednesday. Their chances depended on the results of the other match. The two matches were played at the same time, one in Yekaterinburg, Russia, and the other in Kazan, Russia. Sweden beat Mexico 3-0, winning the group. That result put Germany in a good position to advance as well. All the Germans needed to do was score one goal against the South Koreans. German defender Mats Hummels said after the match, "It's very, very hard to put it into words. We believed until the end today, even when it was 0-1. I think we kept trying to turn it all around." After watching their team play poorly against Sweden, the mood among Mexico fans at the game improved when news came in that South Korean goalkeeper Jo Hyun-woo was preventing Germany from scoring. Then Mexicans at the game and around the world cheered wildly when South Korea scored its first goal. In a Twitter video taken by VOA reporter Ramon Taylor, Mexican fans at an eating place in New York City shouted in Spanish, "Korea," after South Korea scored its first goal. In another Twitter video taken in Mexico City's Zocalo Square, Mexican fans found a South Korean man among the crowd. The fans cheered for him and lifted him above the masses. The person filming the video, Patrick Infurna, said, "Only the World Cup could do this. Only the World Cup could make this happen." Besides Germany this year, France in 2002, Italy in 2010, and Spain in 2014 also got eliminated in the group stage as defending champions. And that's what's trending today.
Scientists have long struggled with how to measure the effects of climate change on wildlife. This is especially true for birds flying in and out of coastal areas bordering the Arctic Ocean. In the past, researchers depended mainly on information gathered by satellite to follow the movement of birds and animals. But this method can be costly and result in huge amounts of information, which can be difficult to process. Now scientists are turning to another kind of technology to help them follow birds and other wildlife. Songbirds are especially difficult to study in the wild. They can fly across thousands of kilometers, and their bodies are too small for electronic tracking devices. A new report tells about a project in which researchers recorded songbirds and then put the sounds into a computer program to be studied. The researchers created machine learning algorithms with the ability to focus on bird calls while ignoring other noises. The algorithm helps improve the likelihood of predicting the correct result. Similar machine learning methods have been used to recognize human speech. Birds are known to make more singing and calling noises after arriving in areas where they plan to mate. Spring is short in extreme northern areas of the American state of Alaska. There, the birds must mate and have their young before winter. The algorithm is designed to use the recordings to estimate when the birds arrive in large groups to begin mating. A lead researcher on the project is Ruth Oliver from Columbia University in New York. Oliver told VOA that she and others traveled to northern Alaska to put recording equipment in four different places. The equipment was used to make 4 half-hour recordings each day. This produced more than 1,200 hours of audio, but not all of it was from birds.
There's a lot of other noise in these recordings. Even in May in northern Alaska, there's lots of wind, lots of rain, and all of that is confounding when you're listening to birds.
Oliver adds that the machine learning method is a valuable tool to help identify and process the most useful parts of the recordings. While some results were produced completely by machine, Oliver said human supervision helped to improve the process. In both cases, the researchers reported the computer was correct in estimating when the birds arrived to their breeding grounds. Oliver says the unsupervised machine learning method could be retooled to use sounds to measure the movements of other wildlife. This could allow us to track large-scale changes in how animals are responding to climate change, she said. Emily Jo Williams is a bird expert with the American Bird Conservancy, a nonprofit group. She told VOA she agrees that machine learning can provide scientists with valuable information about how climate changes are affecting animal populations.
We know from some research that some birds' ranges have actually changed, and they moved in response to what we think is a warming climate.
In another study, researchers reported how machine learning methods can be used to identify, count, and describe animals in the wild. Currently, scientists depend mainly on cameras in the wild to keep track of animals. But just like the first study, The second also points out the problems of trying to deal with the large amounts of information gathered. Processing this data can be costly and involve a lot of people. Researchers created a machine learning system they say uses artificial intelligence, or AI, to identify, count, and describe the behaviors of 48 animal species. They said their method can correctly identify animals at a rate of 94%. The scientists said results showed AI can be used as an effective way to gather a wealth of information on huge numbers of animals in the wild. They say the new methods will save time and costs and can even operate in real time. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal policies during the 1930s changed the face of American government. The new president and the Congress passed legislation that helped farmers, strengthened the banking system, and supplied jobs for millions of workers. One of the results of Roosevelt's policies was a stronger movement of organized labor in America. Sarah Long and Doug Johnson continue the story of the presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal policies during the 1930s changed the face of American government. The new president and the Congress passed legislation that helped farmers, strengthened the banking system, and supplied jobs for millions of workers. One of the most important results of Roosevelt's policies was a stronger American labor movement.
Labor leaders had little success in organizing workers in the United States during the 1920s. Three Republican presidents and a national wave of conservatism prevented them from gaining many members or increasing their negotiating power. In 1929, organized labor fell even further with the beginning of the Great Economic Depression. By 1933, America's labor unions had less than 3 million members. But by the end of the 1930s, more than 10.5 million American workers belonged to unions.
New laws proposed by the Roosevelt administration made the labor growth possible. The National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933 gave labor leaders the right to organize and represent workers. The Supreme Court ruled that the law was illegal. But another law, the Wagner Labor Relations Act of 1935, helped labor unions to increase their power. Most of the leaders of America's traditional labor unions were slow to understand their new power. They were conservative men. They represented workers with certain skills, such as woodworkers or metal workers. They did little to organize workers with other kinds of skills. But a new group of labor leaders used the new laws to organize unions by industries, not by skills. They believed that workers would have much more power if they joined forces with other workers in the same factory to make common demands. These new leaders began to organize unions for the automobile industry, the steel industry, and other major industries.
The leader of the new movement was the head of the mine workers, John L. Lewis. Lewis was a powerful leader with a strong body and strong opinions. He had begun to work in the coal mines at the age of 12. Lewis rose to become a powerful and successful leader of the mine workers, but he was concerned about workers in other industries as well, and he believed that most of the leaders in the American Federation of Labor were doing little to help them. For this reason, Lewis and the heads of several other unions formed their own group to organize unions by industry, not by skills. They called their group the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, and they tried immediately to gain members.
The CIO successfully organized the workers in several major industries, but it succeeded only by hard work and struggle. The CIO's first big battle was against the giant automobile company, General Motors. Late in 1935, workers at several General Motors factories began a sit-down strike at their machines to demand better pay and working conditions. After 45 days, General Motors surrendered. It recognized that the Automobile Workers Union had the right to represent GM workers, and it agreed to negotiate a new work agreement.
The struggle at the Ford Motor Company was more bitter. Ford Company guards beat union organizers and workers. But the Ford Company finally agreed to negotiate with the new union. The same story was true in the steel industry. But the new labor leaders succeeded in becoming the official representatives of steel workers throughout the country. By 1938, the CIO had won its battle to organize major industries. In later years, it would join with the more traditional American Federation of Labor to form the organization that remains the most important labor group in America today, the AFL-CIO.
President Roosevelt was not always an active supporter of organized labor, but neither was he a constant supporter of big business, like the three Republican presidents before him. In fact, Roosevelt spoke out often against the dangers of big business in a democracy. These speeches caused great concern among many of the traditional business and conservative leaders of the nation. And Roosevelt's increasingly progressive policies in 1935 made many richer Americans fear that the president was a socialist, a dictator, or a madman. Former President Herbert Hoover, for example, denounced Roosevelt's New Deal policies as an attack on the whole idea of individual freedoms. The family of business leader J.P. Morgan told visitors not to say Roosevelt's name in front of Morgan. They said it would make his blood pressure go up.
This conservative opposition to Roosevelt grew steadily throughout 1935 and 36. Many Americans were honestly worried that Roosevelt's expansion of government was the first step to dictatorship. They feared that Roosevelt and the Democrats were trying to gain power as the Nazis did in Germany, the fascists in Italy, or the communists in Russia.
The Republican Party held its presidential convention in the summer of 1936. The party delegates chose Alfred Landon to oppose Roosevelt for president. Mr. Landon was the governor of the farm state of Kansas. He was a successful oil producer with conservative business views. But he was open to some of the social reforms of Roosevelt's New Deal. Republicans hoped he would appeal to average Americans who supported mild reforms but feared Roosevelt's social policies. The Democrats nominated Roosevelt and Vice President John Garner to serve a second term.
The main issue in the presidential campaign of 1936 was Franklin Roosevelt himself. Roosevelt campaigned across the country like a man sure that he would win. He laughed with the cheering crowds and told them that the New Deal had helped improve their lives. In New York, Roosevelt made a major speech promising to continue the work of his administration if he was reelected.
Of course, we will continue to seek to improve working conditions for the workers of America. Of course, we will continue to work for cheaper electricity in the homes and on the farms of America. For better and cheaper transportation, for low interest rates, for sounder home financing, for better banking, for the regulation of security issues, for reciprocal trade among nations, and my friends, for all of these, we have only just begun to fight.
The Republican candidate, Alfred Landon, began his campaign by saying that many of Roosevelt's New Deal programs were good. But he said that a Republican administration could do them better and for less money. However, Landon's words became much stronger as the campaign continued. He attacked many of Roosevelt's programs. The campaign became increasingly bitter. Roosevelt said his opponents cared only about their money, not about other Americans. "I welcome their hatred," he said. Landon's supporters accused Roosevelt of destroying the nation's economic traditions and threatening democracy.
The nation had not seen such a fierce campaign in 40 years. But when it was over, the nation also saw a victory greater than any in its history. Franklin Roosevelt defeated Alfred Landon in the election of 1936 by one of the largest votes in the nation's history. Roosevelt won every state except Maine and Vermont. The huge election victory marked the high point of Roosevelt's popularity. In our next program, we will look at the many problems he faced in his second administration.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.